Always a pleasure to be here. Yeah, so today I'm basically going to be telling you guys about ways to constrain magnetically charged particles. This is some work in progress with Curly at Stanford, and hopefully should be done sometime this year. Okay. So particle physics is basically all about finding new particles. It's in the title. And so, well, we found a lot, the sort of the particles that make us up, force carriers, et cetera, et cetera. And so when looking for new particles, there are basically two classes of new particles. They can either be heavy, which basically means we haven't seen them because they're just too heavy to be produced so far, or they can be light and weakly coupled, which is basically just the statement that it's really hard to produce and really hard to see. And so the way you sort of look for these types of particles is, well, for heavy particles, it's actually very simple. You just collide things at higher and higher energies. For these lighter but more weakly coupled particles, you just have to do the experiment many, many times. You have to just have high intensity, high luminosity, and just repeat things a lot. So those are the two basic approaches. So when looking for heavy particles, well, this is sort of the canonical example. It's a collider. And so the LHC basically is looking for new particles by colliding things at higher and higher energies. And actually, when looking for new heavy particles, pretty much this is good enough, because at high energies, things interconvert. And so you just have to collide stuff at high energies. It doesn't matter too much what it is. It will matter to at order one factors, but to zeroth order, you just take things, collide them harder and harder, more and more energies, and then you're good. Okay, yes. And then go to high enough energies, and even that won't matter.
Yeah. Very high, yeah.
Yeah. And then it's actually the opposite is true for very light particles, which is it's very, rather than just a single basic idea of an experiment, you need many, many different types of experiments. The reason for this is that, the particles are very, well, they don't really interconvert at low energies. An electron is very distinct from any quarks or from like a proton or a neutron. And so what you need to do is then it matters what you couple to, and then it also matters how you couple to it. Whether do you couple like it has an electric charge, do you couple like a dipole moment, Yukawa interactions or whatnot. And so basically, because you have many different options, like what particle you couple to, how it couples, you have many different types of experiments. And so I'm just gonna review a few basic ones that people talk about. There's sort of the standard high intensity collider, which is just you take a collider, you run it for a very long time to get high intensity, like do it as many times as possible. Okay, so that's pretty simple idea. Another one is just beam dumps, which is you take a beam of stuff, like electrons, protons, positrons, whatever, and you just dump it and hit some sort of target. In this case, it's aluminum. And then after that, you just have a huge bunch of stuff. Usually it's just like a huge bunch of dirt sitting between the target and the detector. And because anything standard model charge will get blocked very easily, right? We're looking for weakly coupled stuff. So weakly coupled stuff can fly through this and then interact with your detector. And so this is sort of the basic idea behind the beam dump. You just do this sort of simple experiment. Alternatively, you can look for your high luminosity by going at high densities. So nature does pretty much everything we do, but better. And so the highest densities can be obtained in neutron stars, sort of these red giants and supernova. And so you can look for new particles in these guys. And essentially, whenever these guys apply, they are almost always the best constraints. So for example, in red giants, we understand them extremely well. So if you have some new weakly coupled particle, it can act as a new energy transport mechanism. It can take energy from the inside of the red giant to the outside, and that's constrained very well. We understand sort of the evolution and behavior of red giants well enough to constrain that sort of stuff. we understand things, they're like cooling arguments. For example, in supernova, you can say that if you create some new particle and it carries more energy away than the entirety of all the energy in the supernova, you know that can't have happened, and it would have fizzled the supernova. And so you can place constraints like that. You can even do some things like produce these guys in supernova and then look for them on Earth, because let's say you do it for the axion. The strongest constraints come from coupling, producing axions at supernova and then having them interconvert into photons on the way here. Okay, so another large energy flux is dark matter. And so you can get at, if the dark matter is lighter than a GeV or so, then you basically will have at least 1 per centimeter cubed. So this is a huge number density flux of dark matter. And so you can use this to do, again, a very high luminosity experiment, of course, assuming that dark matter is light enough. But, and then, so what, one classic example of this is xenon. And so what you do, what they just do is look for the huge flux of dark matter through us, and they look for nuclear recoils off of xenon. And the sort of the last example I'll talk about is basically just the more recent idea of saying, well, if dark matter has a macroscopic size, for example, it takes, let's say, 5 seconds for a dark matter particle, or I guess since it's light enough, you can consider it more like a wave, to pass over us. And if then if it couples to like a dipole or a charge or a mass, then you can look for time-dependent quantities that have this frequency of the dark matter. And so this can, again, place very strong constraints. So these are sort of the general ways to look for new light particles. And so if you want to, well, you're doing a huge broad search. And so you might hope to try to do the simplest thing first, right? And so what you might say is the simplest thing is either a new particle with an old interaction or an old particle with a new interaction. So old particles with new interactions are called fifth force experiments. They're being done. A new particle with old interactions, well, what are the old interactions? At low energies, they're basically gravity and ENM. And so if you want to say, what I'm going to talk about today is just looking for new particles with old interactions. And so that just means a new particle with gravity and or mass and ENM. And so when you talk to this to people, they typically will say, well, we're looking for this very well. They'll show you a plot like this, which is basically the charge, electric charge of the particle versus the mass. And you say, here, there are a huge number of constraints. The strongest are astrophysics. And then as you get to higher energies, there are various things like I mentioned before, like beam dump, supernova, colliders, et cetera, et cetera. And so this is the first thing people will tell you. But of course, there are two charges under the photon, right? It's E and M, so you can have electric or magnetic charges. So what about magnetically charged particles? And I'll get to what I mean by this milli in a moment. And so that's basically the what I'm going to be talking about today, just magnetically charged particles and constraining them. So the rest of my talk is basically describing essentially what I mean by this milli part of the magnetically charged particles. I'll briefly review some constraints and mention a new constraint that we're discussing, and then I'll conclude. Okay. So when people talk about magnetic charges, they're very happy with monopoles, but then they sort of get confused when you say millimagnetic charges, because they say, well, the standard lore is that magnetic charge is quantized. And so let's review that briefly. It's essentially an argument of quantization of angular momentum. So you can actually give this to an undergraduate if you want. You take an electric charge with some charge QE, plop it here. Take a magnetic charge with charge QM and just plop it there. And then say, calculate the angular momentum in this electromagnetic field. After some suffering, they will tell you that it's just this number here. However, we also know quantum mechanics, and quantum mechanics says that the angular momentum is quantized in units of h bar over 2. And so if you just choose this normalization so that you get integers, you'll see that the product of the electric charge and the magnetic charge is an integer. And because we know electrons have QE here equals 1, This means that the monopole charge is quantized. And so this means that there is some minimum magnetic charge. And basically, this is what everyone looks for when they talk about monopoles and whatnot. Sometimes they'll fight about whether or not this is should be one or two, but whatever. OK, so well, since I want to talk about millimagnetically charged particles, I'll have to find a way to get around this argument. And it's actually extremely simple to do this. You just take this argument and replace it with two E and Ms. So let's say there are two E and Ms. Then you just add in a sum to the previous argument. And you get essentially that the sum of the product of the charges is an integer. However, the product of two guys being an integer and the sum being an integer is very different, right? You can have irrational numbers here and just have them sum up to be one. And so as an example of this, well, so essentially what happens is that the angular momentum in one E and M field is canceled by the angular momentum in the other. So here's just sort of a proof of principle that'll actually be somewhat my guiding model in this theory, which is if you have an electron that's charged 1 under 1 E and M and epsilon under another, and you have a monopole that's 1 under this other guy but minus epsilon under the first one, then you can see that the product, like minus epsilon plus epsilon, is 0. And so that the angular momentum carried in one field is canceled by the other. So hopefully this was a very sort of simple example, but the argument is that sort of millimagnetic charges are possible. But then there's the question of, are they plausible, right? Because what is the probability if you randomly chose charges that you'd get exactly an assignment like this, right? Like epsilon here and minus epsilon here, and they cancel and everything. And epsilon is some fractional number, and people tend to like integer charges. So my claim will be that this is just as plausible as any other scenario sort of that involves dark photons. And to sort of convince you of this, I really have to address two things. One is that I have to address this fractional charges and the fact that these two are exactly minus one of each other. I'll also have to explain, well, it's really talking more about a theory bias against monopoles at low energies. OK. So let's first talk about the fractional charges. So let's look at kinetic mixing. So if you have two photons, you can write down the kinetic terms for the two photons. This is just the standard kinetic terms. And it is gauge invariant to write something called the kinetic mixing term, which basically mixes our photon with their photon. And so usually what people do is they don't like this mixing, and so they get rid of it by a field redefinition, which basically involves sending our photon to our photon plus epsilon times their photon. And in this process, this makes our electron charge an epsilon amount under their guys. And so you can see that because epsilon is a random Lagrangian parameter, it changes under RG evolution and everything, that it's perfectly natural for it to be a fractional number. And so just under this discussion alone, you'd say that if you originally had an electron under us and a monopole under them, that our electron would pick up an epsilon charge. However, you know this cannot be the entire story because there's quantization of angular momentum. So basically, because without epsilon, you had angular momentum was OK, adding this kinetic mixing is not going to break quantum mechanics. Angular momentum should still be quantized, and so something must change with the dark monopole's charged assignments. So in fact, you can guess what it is. This kinetic mixing term mixes our E field with their E field, our B field with their B field. And so you can see that if this guy's charge is going to change, it has to be a magnetic charge that changes. It has to pick up some magnetic charge under us, and consistency will tell you it's minus epsilon. And in fact, it's not, yeah.
I may be jumping ahead now. Mm-hmm. But if the gluon has a mass and a monopole's free,
No, they are confined.
Okay.
And so the direct stream will be physical, for example.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that's one of the ways you can imagine that you're getting around the standard,
yeah.
the direct stream argument, is that it's just a physical object.
Yes, exactly. So
mm-hmm.
so you will assume that that mass is zero?
I will assume that it's small, but non-zero. I'll get to it in a moment.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So actually, you can do things like solve the Tuft polycol monopole with kinetic mixing, and you see that the monopoles pick up a minus epsilon. But in fact, you can argue that generally. And so the way to see how magnetic charges sort of transform under a field redefinition, you can just go back to sort of the standard trick of doing things like in electromagnetic duality, where you, if you just take a kinetic term that's F squared, and you add a term, a Lagrange multiplier, G, here, this basically enforces the Bianchi identity. And so if you integrate out G, you just have your theory of the photon. If you integrate out F, you get your theory of the dual photon, which is described by this G guy, which you can see by just, for example, adding in a source for G, and you see that it's basically that del dot B is equal to whatever source you just added. And so if you take your theory here, and you're saying, well, I want to know what happens to the magnetic charges under this field redefinition. Well, you're doing the field redefinition, F goes to A plus epsilon times D to sort of get rid of kinetic mixing. But then you'll notice that this messes up your Lagrange multiplier interactions. And so you also have to send your magnetic charges to minus epsilon times B. And so notice that this field reassignment takes their monopoles and makes them minus epsilonly charged under us. And so you see that after this field redefinition, everything is canonical. G again describes magnetic guys, but that their monopoles have picked up a minus epsilon charge under us. And so you really do just get this, you see that this there's an epsilon here and a minus epsilon there. Okay.
So for the normal charges, the other photon's massless, then you can just define it away.
Yeah, so
if you're right, there's actually.
So this is just a statement of how the field redefinitions vary the various charges. Why you chose this particular field redefinition has to do with the existence of the mass.
Okay.
Right, because if the other guy was massless, you could remove this. If there was no mass term, you could remove this by this field redefinition, you could remove it by another field redefinition. There are many ways to remove it.
So let's take it massless for simplicity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then, well, if because I'm a bit confused, that depends on the definition, but there's a physical.
Yeah.
Right.
So
there's a particle there. That's a standard way of getting charged particle.
Yeah.
So if this guy is massless, so it's quite clear. Also, if there is a magnetically charged particle there, it will become immediately charged
under us.
Magnetically
yeah,
charged
that's right.
Just because there is small mixing
yeah.
in whatever source.
That's
there.
Right.
So in that sense, that's a bit strange. Field redefinition. It's the monational one, which makes those ones, those particles charged with respect to us.
Yeah.
So
why I choose this field redefinition, I'll actually go into a little clearer later.
Right.
It'll have to do with essentially this mass term,
yeah.
which is the statement that they're Higgs and we are not.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll talk about actually physical things that are invariant under this field redefinition.
Right.
And then it'll be clear. More clear what I mean when I say these guys are actually millicharged and whatnot. Okay, so before, I'll talk about that after I first talk about what I mean by sort of monopoles at low energies. This is essentially just a strong theory bias against light monopoles. The reason why there is this really strong theory bias is that monopoles were originally discovered in grand unified theories, which happen at very high energies. And so at high energies, people just assumed that monopoles would be heavy because of this. So people, it's really a more theoretical bias reason that people don't like monopoles. So if you don't like monopoles, I'd just say Maxwell's equations have E and M electromagnetic duality, right? What you call electric and what you call magnetic is a complete arbitrary choice. And so we could have, for example, called our electron magnetically charged, and all of the physics would still be exactly the same. So let's just do this field redefinition on the other sector. And so now instead of kinetic mixing, I have an electric magnetic mixing, where I mix our E field with their B field and their B field with our E field. And then the magnetic mass is now going to be some, well, I wrote it rather cavalierly here. It's going to be a Stackelberg mass for their dual photon. So it'll be some non-local horrendous mass. But OK. But from this point of view, then you just say that, well, it's magnetic mixing. So our electron picks up a small magnetic charge under them. Their electron picks up a small magnetic charge under us. And that's essentially the end of story. Okay, yeah, it's just the dark electron in their sector with magnetic mixing and a magnetic Stackelberg mass. Okay, so now let's try to talk about what's the physical picture, right? What does it mean? Why did I choose this basis choice, et cetera, et cetera? What do these guys actually physically look like?
Sorry, I'm still confused.
Yeah.
So if you just forget about the mass term, like Sergey was saying, there are still a physical milli charged monopole.
So I think I'm actually going to talk about it right here in a moment. So you can sort of picture it somewhat like this. They have something like a Higgs giving them a mass. Us, our electron, because of this field redefinition, I chose to keep the mass only in their sector and not in ours. Our electron picks up an epsilon charge under them. Their monopole picks up a minus epsilon charge under us. So because their sector is Higgs, their monopoles are confined. We know that Higgsing is dual to confinement. And so just like QCD, there will be strings connecting these monopoles with an antimonopole. So what these monopoles will look like is essentially an antimonopole connected to a monopole with a string. So it's basically just like QCD, right? QCD has quarks connected with strings. Here we just have monopoles connected with strings. And so if you remember sort of Dirac's argument against monopole charge, his statement was he was looking for when he could make the string unphysical. And it turns out because I don't obey the Dirac quantization condition, I have a millimagnetic charge, the Dirac string is physical. OK, that's fine. We're not too unhappy with strings. We've observed them in nature in QCD. OK, so the next thing is, so why is this mass term needed, right? So in particular, if the dark photon is irrelevant, what does physics look like? Well, if you look at the electron generates an electric and magnetic field that's E and B. And because there's an epsilon charge under them, it generates a charge electric field for them that's epsilon times the electric field, epsilon times the magnetic field. Now, if you look at what the monopole feels, it feels minus epsilon 1. So if you just take minus epsilon plus this guy, you get 0. And so you'd say that this monopole and the electron do not interact at all if I neglect the mass. In other words, if I neglect the mass, these guys really don't look like monopoles at all, right? I can choose a basis where I might say they look like a monopole, but they're not actually monopoles because they don't interact with the electron like a millimagnetically charged particle. So now let's add the mass. Well, we know what happens when you add a mass to a photon, right? It becomes a superconductor. We know how B fields behave in a superconductor. They're exponentially screened by the mass of the photon. And so what you see now then is how this monopole interacts with the electron is, well, there's an exponential part, which is their photon interaction. And then there's a part that isn't exponentially screened. And so you can see that if you're at very close distances, the electron and the monopole do not interact. But if you're at long distances, distances longer than 1 over the mass of the dark photon, this guy goes to 0. And the effective B field that it sees is epsilon times B. And so at long distances, it looks like a monopole with epsilon charge. At close distances, it just doesn't interact at all. And so what we're going to have to do then is talk about physics.
I'm confused about massless case. So what's the difference between charged particles there? So if it's massless, charged particles there become mini charged.
Yeah, so if it's massless, you can work in a basis where you can redefine a basis where the electron is only charged under one E and M and the monopole is only charged in the other. In other words, they do not interact at all.
No.
If you have no mass,
then you have particles that are charged under the other one, there's still an interaction between the electron and the other guys.
Yeah.
So
there's no charge between the monopole and the in their sector and the electron in ours, right? Because this guy generates a field that's just
for
E.
The monopole, you mean.
Yeah. I'm not talking about electrons in their sector. I'm talking about monopoles.
Yeah, so I'm trying to see what's the difference.
Yes.
You have two fields instead.
The difference is, right, you can look at the interaction between H prime, like a charged Higgs-like object, and an electron-like object in their sector and our electron, and you see there will be an interaction that's of order epsilon. But you, if you look at the monopoles in their sector interacting with us, there is no interaction.
It's
confusing, right?
It's essentially because I chose the monopole. The monopoles are different from electrons because there's the direct quantization condition. If you have two electrically charged objects, you get no E cross B, and so you never, right, because you don't generate B. And so you never, quantization of angular momentum doesn't place any constraints when, if you just have electrically charged particles. The non-trivial cancellations happen when you have magnetic. And they have quantized magnetic charge. Yeah.
No, but as you said, this kinetic mixing doesn't violate any quantization.
Yeah.
No.
And so the statement is if they don't interact, then yeah, you can always choose a basis between.
So basically, if you had a magnetic monopole in their sector that was newly charged under our sector with just the photon, then that would violate direct quantization.
Yeah. And so you need this cancellation to happen for consistency of quantization of angular momentum. But for electrically charged particles only, you don't need any cancellation because there's no equivalent quantization condition.
The electron is sourcing a little bit of the.
What happens if I have monopoles, charged black holes that are monopoles under the U1?
Which
U1?
Are U1 or their U1?
Their U1.
Their U1, then yeah, there's a small epsilon charge under us.
That's still no interaction between our electron and the magnetic charge of the black hole.
Right.
That cancels.
Essentially, quantization of angular momentum forces the interaction to cancel between these two at short distances. And then when you go to long distances, magnetic fields are screened, so you can ignore these guys. So at long distances, it looks like you just see this minus epsilon. So we know superconductors screen magnetic fields. This is experimentally known. And so
we're talking about massive case now.
Yeah, so
I'm
the
massive case. About massive case.
Yes. No, let's think about it later, because for me it's confusing too, but we won't continue.
Yeah, in the end I'll be interested in the massive case, where you just at long distances, and so you can essentially ignore this additional E prime and B prime, and you just see this guy here, and so you only see the minus epsilon a monopole. But and then the way it gets around, for example, direct quantization in angular momentum is by having a physical string.
So you really want to consider a massless case? Is it heavily constrained by the defective?
Yeah, so if you consider a massless case, because these two guys don't interact, we have no constraints on it. And so, I mean, I'm going to be interested in the massive case. And I mean, because also in the massless case, there's no sense in which it actually behaves like a monopole, because it doesn't have interact with our B field. OK, so what are constraints on magnetically charged particles? What do they look like? So the strongest constraints come from actually, if you assume there's some primordial abundance, like for some reason cosmology generated monopoles, then there are actually pretty strong astrophysical constraints. There are also experimental constraints, just like looking for monopoles in rocks and things like that. But it turns out there's something called the Parker bound, which is the strongest constraint, which, so the idea behind the Parker bound is just that magnetic fields accelerate monopoles. This energy has to come from somewhere. It comes from the B squared energy density of the magnetic field. And so if there exists some primordial amount of monopoles, then what happens is the galactic magnetic fields will accelerate these guys, and these guys will suck energy out of the galactic magnetic fields. And so if it sucks up too much energy, if there's too many of these guys around, then the galactic magnetic fields just cannot exist. And so their very existence shows that the flux of dark of monopole charge is smaller than some number. And this actually turns out to be the strongest constraint on any cosmological abundance.
So how do you create these? So if there's a string, why don't we just annihilate the string tensions?
It depends. So we can produce quarks. That doesn't, the fact that strings exist do not mean you cannot create them, right?
No, but then they confine, right? And then depends on
so
the
for example, there's the question is, how do they lose energy so that they can actually collide, right? Because
are they elementary models? Are they topological configuration? Because it's not clear that there is a production cross-section for standard model particles.
Yeah, so I'm actually going to talk about whether they're point-like or extended objects in a moment. But.
Yeah, what is the
string is also pulling on the model.
Yeah, so the question is, if the string has a force that's smaller than just the force on the monopoles from the galactic magnetic fields, then you can just ignore the string entirely, for example. It depends a bit on the what regions of parameter space. But in this, where this guy applies, you have to say that the force from the galactic magnetic fields is stronger than the string pulling on them. Sure.
So then why are the strings, why haven't they annihilated today?
It depends on how they lose energy, right? If you have two guys rotating about each other, they have to lose angular momentum first before they can annihilate. And so then there's a question of how do they lose angular momentum? And it turns out that Larmor radiation is exponentially suppressed for them. Because essentially it'll be because these monopoles are more massive than the so for Larmor radiation, the relevant quantity is comparing the acceleration of the object to the mass of their photon, and it will turn out that the acceleration is just smaller than the mass. And so,
collisions between strings and just
yeah, you can do it like that as well.
Continue.
For me, it's impossible to understand what's going on because I don't understand the difference. Just maybe because how everything is massless. So
sure.
The way mean charge particles appears because I go to Bayes where I just shift mirror field, right?
Yeah.
So I have a source of mirror electric field, but I say, well, I go to Bayes where mirror photon is shifted by epsilon visible photon.
Mm-hmm.
This way, any source of mirror electric field becomes epsilonic source of normal electric field. But I don't see how is it different. Now I have a source of mirror magnetic field, and I just shift what I call mirror photon, I shift it by epsilon times visible photon, then it seems to be that source of mirror photon will become also source of mirror.
So the question is, so I guess maybe what you're confused about is, given that I'm removing this field definition, how do I know how the magnetic field transforms? Like how the A tildes?
No, I don't think about that. For me, that's too fancy. I don't want to think about any tildes.
Okay.
I just have a magnetic monopole in that sector, which produces some vector potential, some mirror vector potential.
Yeah.
Now, the most physical choice, when both guys are masses,
yeah.
The most physical choice is to redefine mirror photon by adding, saying, oh, that actually mirror photon is mirror photon plus epsilon visible photon.
Yeah.
And that way, if I have a source of mirror field,
sure.
Becomes epsilonic source of mirror of visible field. But
yeah.
In this argument, I don't see at all difference between electric and magnetic charge.
There is none. So to see a force, you have to work with the physical quantity, right? You have to use something that's basis invariant. So that, let's say, the force between an electron and a monopole, right? And then no matter what basis you choose, that the answer will be they have no force between the two of them.
So I think another way of putting it is you don't have freedom to choose that the magnetic monopole only has charge under the original thing and nothing under ours.
Yeah.
Physically, by the conservation magnetic monopole, it's got to have had the combination of magnetic charge under our photon, their photon.
This is confusing because imagine, right, let's say the invariant thing you have. Basically, you're saying you have a moving charge of our sectors, go back to the moving charge case. You have a moving, produce a magnetic field. I know that the charge of the other sector will feel that magnetic field.
It's got enough charge in the RAS sector that the
Their electric charges will feel it, their magnetic charges will not.
Yeah, but then
It's just.
Well, let's remove the charge. Yeah. Let's remove that magnetic monopole.
Yeah.
Then it produces also electric field, and
yes.
The electric field I should be feeling. So it's really, I don't see.
So, I mean, just take these field assignments and calculate the force between various objects, right? You'll see that there's a force between their electron and something like a dark electron, but there is no force between their electron, our electron and their monopoles, right? Just, you know that the...
Well, I guess that's what everyone understands.
Yeah,
about
because
right?
you have a moving charge,
you generate an epsilon. Oh, theirs is just epsilon times r, so then you just add the two, right?
No, are you assuming, no, but this is confusing, right? Because you're assuming the electron static. What if I start moving the electron?
It doesn't matter. It's just epsilon times rb field, right? If you generate, wiggle r electron and generate a b field for us, because it has an epsilon charge under them, it's equivalent to oscillating an epsilon electric charge under them and get an epsilon magnetic field.
No, that's a very confusing basis. So the standard language is that I have, in situation where I have massless photon, then I have our electron charge is the same, and those particles in that sector become charged under us. Our electron doesn't have, it's coupled to a single photon, it's not charged under
us. Yeah, okay, so if you do, you work in that basis,
right.
This guy becomes an epsilon here, these are just zero, and this monopole does not transform at all.
Well, that's what I don't understand, because to go to that basis...
Yeah, so then it goes back to what I was saying earlier. If you actually have to understand how do magnetic fields transform when you do a basis retransformation in the electric basis.
Well, I don't think about any duality about that, because magnetic sources, well, it's just... I have a source of...
Well, I'm telling you...
Magnetic field,
yeah.
Right? So if I...
If their monopole transformed at all, it would break Dirac quantization. And so you'd have an inconsistent quantum field theory. So the way you want it to transform is just inconsistent with quantum mechanics.
Sorry. Because it's not so very, I'm probably confused about some super simple, but
yeah.
So I have, this is my action, right? So I have,
I don't think I can see anything on that board.
No.
Do we have to work on that board?
We can pass it.
So
this maybe
is
the glare.
Oh, the glare makes it so that they can't see it.
Yeah.
So
maybe you work from there on that board, I guess?
Yeah. I'm sorry for saying, but I really, for me it's impossible to understand anything.
Yeah.
So this is my action schematically. This is
yeah.
So this is kind of our electron, right?
Yeah.
Then I have the A squared, the B squared, this is photon, and then I have
epsilon. Whatever, it's fine.
DBDA. Right?
Yeah.
Well, and then I might have some extra. Say d minus b chi squared, right? So
yeah,
this,
sure. Some electron.
Now, the person is massive. So, general, says, okay, we keep a because that's what our electron is coupled
sure.
to. And we say that b
goes to
is
minus
b
epsilon,
minus epsilon
a. Yeah.
times a. So, and that's called b tilde. And that way, any source that I have, that removes this mixing.
Yep.
But if I have any source of mirror stuff, so if it was sourcing D, now it becomes star sourcing
yes.
A. So if I had a monopole in that sector.
No, but monopoles are not sourced by B. They're support they're by their dual.
No, but
right?
Dual, this is just fancy language, but it's something physical. Monopole is just like physical, it's a source of vector potential, right? So let's describe everything in physical terms. It's an object which creates physical vector potential. So if, and they don't why matters here whether I shift in B0 or B R. So okay, if I have a source of physical vector potential, I shift it by epsilon, it becomes a source of physical potential in our sector. That's what I'm confused about.
Mm. I guess the statement is what you're saying is the problem is that if you have like R E field B E prime B prime, you have an E which is 1 0 0 0 and M, which is 0 0 0 1, and then you say I do this field redefinition.
Right.
You want to say that this picks up a minus epsilon charge.
Right.
But my statement is this is inconsistent with quantization of angular momentum.
This sounds a very complicated combination of angular momentum. Let's think about this theory. When epsilon was zero, this was at this theory could produce a monopole.
Okay.
Right?
So
this is definitely allowed theory. Now, let's add this term in Lagrangian.
Yeah.
Sure, it doesn't. It's still a local theory. It doesn't violate angular momentum conservation. It's,
yeah.
It's possibly okay theory. So.
So, but I mean, how do you define what's the charge of the monopole now? Since
no,
you,
no,
it's a non-local.
Yeah,
it's non-local, right? You're trying to write a theory.
No, it's just a soliton of that series. It's a soliton.
Yeah.
And which produces that hidden field.
Yeah.
But now what I call physical field, what I measure, what my electrons is, it seems big, because essentially what can do perturbatively in epsilon, just if I have source on B in the presence of this, but I can do it differently. I can, if I just write the equation with respect to B, then I find that there is contribution, but like B squared A, we get sourced by the stuff, right? So there is a mixing.
No, if in other words, if the Mealy charged particle sourced the B field, right,
mm-hmm.
of the other guy, so why doesn't the monopole create the same? Because
right.
it's just a B field. You
right.
don't know what sources it. I
yeah.
can create a situation where I have a constant B field by putting a series of magnetic monopoles. It looks the same, but you're telling me now if I have an electrically charged particle that sources
yeah.
that are making them go around
yeah,
the circle.
Yeah, exactly. Let's
yeah.
say you're not a monopole. Let's just have some constant B field in that sector.
Yes.
I would
mm-hmm.
feel it here,
yes.
but with epsilon extremes.
Yes.
Yeah. So what's the difference?
What's
if there's how B field knows whether it's produced by monopole
or
by electric
charges? Yes.
It
should, you shouldn't be able to tell the difference.
No, because the monopole wasn't just sourcing stuff in this place, it wasn't just sourcing stuff in that sector, it was sourcing the B.
No, but let's think in this basis.
Yeah.
Epsilon equal to zero, there is a monopole
yeah.
in that sector.
No, but the question is in that sector. You're not allowed to say in that sector. There's got to be a monopole.
No. Epsilon equal to zero.
Okay.
You said don't talk to each other
sure.
at all.
Yes.
And I can have a monopole in this sector.
And then we deform away. And the question is what fields the monopole sourcing?
But
as you form epsilon.
But then you can put it in epsilon. At other epsilon, it's just.
Yes.
Just
if I can create a magnet, forget about charges,
right.
I can assume
yeah.
that there is a flux in space of that U1.
Yeah.
Right? So I have a big field of that U1 in space
yeah.
as a background field.
But that's not what this. That's not what the monopole of the theory is.
No, why?
Yeah.
Because
why?
The monopole, that's not a consistent monopole.
No,
that's
why
monopole.
Is it not?
This
theory
is a consistent monopole. Because
yes.
this kinetic mixing doesn't affect at all the,
yes.
those monopoles.
It does, but that's the. It does.
Why?
Why?
Because that would make it inconsistent, right?
Why would it
No, because for me, I should be careful writing all this direct quantization condition because it also implies that electric charge is quantized, but we know it's not quantized in such a situation.
Yes.
So I'm a bit suspicious about, for sure I can do it properly.
No, if you source a B field, right, put in the background field, the flux. So you have a certain. Turn on a B field of the Q1 in our universe. If you have the kinetic mix in our sector, then electrons would feel that B field.
Yes.
So why does it matter where it sources from? Moving charges or a magnetic monopole? This is it appears
yeah.
to be a qualitative difference in where the B field is coming from. It's like the force knows.
Right? Yeah,
I guess in spaces. Okay, we're just repeating that we're looping. Maybe
yeah.
do this afterwards.
Yeah, maybe we should just do it afterwards and then.
You can
yeah.
write this thing down
yeah.
for that.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's just go back to constraints on monopoles. And so, well, I mentioned the Parker bound, which applies if monopoles already exist. Right, if there's some cosmological abundance.
Sorry, actually, just on that.
Sure.
So you're saying that you want force to be greater than the force of the string.
Yeah, so we can
treat
them as free monopoles.
But won't the free string break?
No. It only breaks in QCD because there are particles lighter than the confinement scale. And so,
so
it's exponentially suppressed if there are particles, only particles heavier than the confinement scale.
Okay, so take the monopole mass to be heavier than the scale.
Yeah. And so, okay, so if they're not surrounding us, there's essentially no constraints. And the reason why is that a lot of the times monopoles are sort of non-perturbative objects. And so let's very quickly review why you cannot produce non-perturbative objects, essentially. So when I'm saying non-perturbative, I just mean extended. By extended, it's just the physical size of the object is larger than 1 over m. So in other words, their physical size is larger than the Compton wavelength. So now imagine trying to physically create a monopole of this, it doesn't even need to be a monopole, some non-perturbative object like this. You're trying to pair produce them. So you're colliding two objects with energy at least m, which means the physical size of these particles you're colliding to create the monopole is 1 over m. And so let's take the limit where, let's say m is like TeV, sort of LHC energies, and R is the size of a table. What you're trying to do is you're trying to take tiny little particles like at an LHC beam collision and then popping out something the size of a table out of this. And so obviously because the length scales don't match at all, there is gonna be some exponential suppression of the production of these non-perturbative guys.
So think of it as like, again, QCD, you are able to produce pions and things which are enormous compared to the size of the point.
No, so what you do is you produce electric quarks, and then when they're at long distances,
yeah,
you produce pions.
Sure, so in this kind of case,
and so
you can't produce monopoles in a non-perturbative way.
Yeah. Yeah. The same is, you have to produce something that's color charged in the first place.
Yeah.
And there you're producing quarks, not pions.
Sure.
And here there's nothing else charged under the monopole to try to create, to sort of give these guys as radiation or anything like that.
Okay, so assuming the theory is such that this is.
So I'm saying the monopoles are the only thing in the dark sector for now.
Okay.
You can't produce them directly. You might be able to produce them indirectly, but if in the absence of anything else, you can't produce them.
You're just saying that you cannot produce it through colliding things.
Yeah,
okay.
That's right. And so if there's no cosmological abundance, the only other way to have produced them is by collisions. And so this is why essentially that if they're not cosmologically produced, they're not physically produced, scattering, there's basically no constraint because you can't ever get them to even exist in our universe.
Well, thermally, because
it's
arguing for two particles collisions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You have some thermal object where thermalization.
That's right. This is why I said the caveat of a cosmological abundance, because that's generally you go above some phase transition,
yeah,
you go to some lower.
No, but not
a phase
transition, just in the star.
Yeah.
So if it's sufficiently dense, it will get
produced. So yes, and I don't think people have done that calculation, but even in the most optimistic case for the scenario for those, the bounds I'm going to talk about later are going to be like five orders of magnitude stronger than any solar constraints.
So how non-perturbative is this? Like, if you have like
I mean, it depends, right? You could just say they're fundamental, and then this is not a problem, and then you could produce them.
Right.
But you could also just say they're non-perturbative, and then get around essentially all of the constraints.
So if you have like a heavier collision, then you have a larger clumps of things colliding, maybe you can create it, like, I don't know, like even if...
Well, I mean, this goes back to what Sergey was
right.
saying, like if it can do anything like more than one-on-one, like many-on-many, then you can do it. And so in thermal systems and whatnot. Yeah, so okay, so this is just what I said. So the goal is basically to find some new model-independent bounds on magnetically charged particles. Because perturbative production can be exponentially suppressed, we're going to need some non-perturbative production. And so, to get around exponential suppression, you need exponentially large number of initial states. It's magnetically charged, so photons. And so basically, we're talking about very large E and B fields here. And so there's actually a very well-known production mechanism for particles and E and B fields. It's called Schwinger pair production. And actually, Schwinger originally basically derived the probability of creating particles per unit time, per unit volume, for electrically charged particles. But Affleck and Montan showed it for magnetically charged particles, and they even showed that it still applies to non-perturbative objects. So sort of like Toft-Polyakov monopoles. And so you basically get exactly the same result between the two. I guess the way I wrote it for fermions here and scalars here, and so that's why there's a factor of two, but whatever. And so like I said before, whenever there's an exponential, you can understand it sort of physically by a separation of scales.
Yeah,
and so, yeah.
Why is there this g squared over
4
in the exponent?
Because here is, Schwinger did it in a perturbative expansion of E, so he didn't see plus E squared over 4 here. If you did it to the next order,
so
you'd see a plus E squared over 4 there. It's just that normally, if E is small, G is large, and so this term is important for the monopoles.
And it's plus,
and it turns out to be plus, yeah.
So it helps.
So it helps production, yeah. Basically, physically, what happens in this case is And here they have to get within a distance 1/m of each other. Here they need to get distance that's basically within the Tuft-Polyakov monopole distance of each other, which is larger than 1/m. And so this actually is helped. Yeah. The invariant statement is they have to get to within 1/their size of each other.
Yes.
And for monopoles, that's actually larger than, for Tuft-Polyakov monopoles, they're physically larger than their 1/m. Yeah. Okay. So yeah, so next, let's just get a physical understanding of this exponential here, right? Because like I mentioned before, every exponential in quantum mechanics can be understood as a difference in time scales or length scales. And so why is it m squared over the electric field?
Sorry.
Sure.
did you just frame your pair prediction?
Yes.
So they have to be apart by more than their size. So isn't it worse if they're bigger?
No, I'll get to that in a second. So let's understand this m squared over electric field. And so, electric fields are easier to understand in 2D, but this works just as well in 4D. Imagine there are two equal energy configurations that you're jumping from. You're jumping from a uniform electric field to an electric field with two point particles, right? Electron here, positron here. And conservation of energy just says that the E squared minus E inside here squared has to be equal to the mass of the two particles. So essentially that the distance between these two guys, E times the distance times the electric field is 2 times the mass. In 4D, this is just the dipole energy. This is what conservation of energy tells us. So it basically says that the distance between the two particles you're creating is m over the electric field. And then you say, well, if you're trying to create two electrons macroscopically distance apart, that's kind of hard. But so what's the quantum mechanical fuzz associated to an electron? Well, it's 1/m. And so what you see is that your physical intuition is really that if the distance scale is smaller than 1/m, so if the electron and positron are basically right on top of each other, you can't really distinguish them, then you'll say that quantum mechanics is perfectly happy with jumping from one to the other. And the process would be no longer exponentially suppressed. And so if you solve for when the distance equals 1/m, this is m squared over e. And so this is exactly the physical suppression that you're getting in Schwinger pair production. It's the statement that the electron and positron have to be close enough to each other that you can't even really physically tell that there's a electron-positron pair. Okay. So that explains the exponential. You don't get the pi, but who cares? It's order one numbers. And then the fact that it's proportional to e squared is basically dimensional analysis. E is the largest thing in the problem at that point, and so that's the only thing it can be proportional to. And so, this is Schwinger pair production for particles. What about for these monopole-like objects with a string? Well, now it's basically Schwinger pair production of quarks. So there's an additional string between the two. And what I mentioned before was completely an energetics argument, right? It was comparing the energy. And so all we need to do is say that the energy of the string is small compared to everything else, and then you can neglect it. Equivalently, you could also just do the standard instanton calculation with the Nambu-Goto action for the string, and you get this same result that essentially if the mass of the monopole is much larger than the confinement scale, then the string does not matter for a Schwinger pair production. And so this sort of goes back to why I was looking at the case where the monopoles are more massive than the confinement scale. Okay, so if I want, if you can get unsuppressed sort of this Schwinger pair production in large magnetic fields, well, what are the largest magnetic fields in the universe, right? I want to constrain these guys. The largest magnetic fields are in magnetars. And so you can use magnetars to constrain the universe, constrain these particles, just like the way you use the Parker bound. The very existence of these magnetic fields implies that Schwinger pair production cannot have been happening at a rate fast enough to neutralize it. So that's essentially going to be how the constraint comes about. So P people may not be familiar with magnetars, but magnetars are essentially just neutron stars with extremely large magnetic fields. They have a physical size of about 10 kilometers. They have B fields that are about 10 to the 15 Gauss or so. And in particle physics units, that's about capital MeV squared. So they have pretty huge magnetic fields. Their age is anywhere between 10 to the 3 and 10 to the 5 years. And their luminosity is basically about 10 to the 35 ergs per second, which roughly coincides with the B squared V over T. And equivalently, this is what leads people to suspect that magnetars are powered by their magnetic fields. We've seen about 20 of them. They're about kiloparsecs away. And aside from this, there's not really much known about them. These are sort of, we've only seen 20, and so we really just don't know very much. So the way we sort of saw them were, there are actually two ways. First way was they're anomalous X-ray pulsars. So the anomalous in here is that they're X-ray pulsars that are not powered by the standard means. The standard means of powering a pulsar is accretion and its angular momentum. And in both cases, that's way too small of a energy scale to give to power these guys. The other way is that there are soft gamma ray repeaters. In particular, there's just huge gamma ray bursts that happen, and then whose peak luminosity is larger than the Eddington limit. And then they die off with some rather broad tail. And so since the magnetic field is important, I'm going to review briefly how we know the magnetic fields of these guys. If you talk to experts, they'll say the main evidence for the magnetic fields comes from the gamma ray bursts. There are basically two things that convince them of this. It's first that the strong magnetic fields basically allow you to have these super Eddington luminosities. The next is that more complicated thing of where they look at the tail of the gamma ray burst, and the lifetime matches various magnetic instabilities of the magnetar only when the B field is 10 to the 15 Gauss or so. However, these are pretty in-depth complicated calculations, and so let's do a really crude estimate of the magnetic field. So if you would just approximate the magnetar as just a ball that's spinning with momentum or angular frequency W omega, and it's a magnetic dipole, this means that there's going to be electromagnetic radiation. This electromagnetic radiation then slows down the rotation of the neutron star. And so what you do is you just calculate the energy being emitted, set that equal to the 1/2 I omega squared ddt of that, and then you can calculate estimate the B field. And so when you do that, you get essentially a formula like this, and you plug in things like the size being 10 kilometers, the period being a few seconds. We've measured dpdt to be 10 to the minus 10, and you just pop out 10 to the 15 Gauss. And so this is a really crude estimate. There are ways which it can go wrong, but it gives the correct answer to up to order one numbers. And so this is sort of gives you a reason why it shouldn't surprise you too much that these things have such large magnetic fields. So this is a zeroth order crude way of guesstimating its magnetic field, and it's ginormous. So given these huge uncertainties, I'm basically just going to take the following values. The size is going to be about 10 kilometers. The B fields are 10 to the 15 Gauss, and its age is going to be 10 to the 4 years. And so this is sort of the physical picture I'm going to look at. I'm going to imagine there's a small sphere where inside the B field is just MeV squared, or more precisely 10 to the 15 Gauss. And then outside it's zero. Inside this little dot here is the neutron star or magnetar itself. Remember what I mentioned before, B effective is just epsilon B times minus M e to the IR. So basically, the statement was, in order to actually feel this magnetic field, you needed it to be a distance at least 1/1 confinement scale away. So if the neutron star here is generating your magnetic field, there's a small sphere in here where B is effectively zero, B effective is zero, and outside B effective is just epsilon MeV squared. And so in here you cannot have Schwinger pair production because the effective B field that the monopoles are feeling is zero. But out here you can, it's just MeV squared, epsilon MeV squared. And so the statement is just then, well, this means that the radius here is larger than 1 over m, which essentially, when you work it through, corresponds to the fact that the monopoles have a physical size that's smaller than the magnetar, which also makes sense because the Schwinger pair production was done in an external field. And so you can't really treat an external field, treat it as an external field if the field is smaller than the object itself. Okay, so that just basically means the bound will apply as long as your object is smaller than 10 kilometers. Okay, so how much energy is extracted from the magnetic field, right? It's just force times distance. So that's that guy here where R is 10 kilometers, B is the magnetic field, QM is the magnetic charge of this guy.
So this kind of emission, so you also have the emission, right? So this is also a form of like radiation, like emission.
Sure.
And then you determine your B field with the emission, right? So
That emission comes at the expense. So when you determine look at the dipole radiation, that comes at the expense of angular momentum.
Right. Oh, right.
This comes at the expense of the B field itself. And so this neutralizes and destroys. For example, that radiation does not occur if the neutron star was not spinning. This would still proceed if the neutron star was at rest, because it just neutralizes the B field itself. And so if you just look at the energy, so there are two ways of saying the bound. You can either say that the total energy lost from production of new particles is smaller than the observed total energy loss, or you can just say that the magnetic field has not been neutralized in the entire lifetime. Because magnetars are powered by their magnetic fields, these are equivalent statements. But it's just Schwinger pair production times the amount of energy taken away. And so what you get is a bound that looks something like this. If this is the magnetic charge and this is the mass, that essentially, the two ways of understanding it is here on this side, you hit the exponential suppression. This is the e to the minus m squared over the field that I sort of mentioned before from Schwinger pair production. And down here, the energy loss is just too small. It's such a small charge that it doesn't neutralize the magnetic field of the magnetar in our lifetime. And so what you see here is notice that the bound here is at around 10 to the minus 19. So this is 5 orders of magnitude stronger than constraints on even electrically charged particles. And so generically, what you then see is, what you see is just that the bound coming from magnetic charges is just ridiculously strong compared to the electric charges. And so you basically went from a case which had essentially no bounds to a case which is bound stronger than even the electrically charged guys. So to conclude, I think it's sort of interesting to think about both electric and magnetic charges, milli-electric and milli-magnetic charges. There are essentially no real model-independent bounds if you take them to be non-perturbative objects. If you take them to be perturbative objects, the bounds come in at around 10 to the minus 10, so up here. So you can see that they would be much weaker than this guy.
So that is a Parker bound?
No. So if you just assume they're point-like particles, then supernova create roughly calculable thing, and its bound is q smaller than 10 to the minus 10 is excluded. So you get an exclusion that's here. And it's still, there are 9 orders of magnitude difference between the two. And so it's sort of amusing that you can use Schwinger pair production And the existence of these huge magnetic fields to sort of place really strong model-independent bounds. All right, thanks.
Not that one. So the pulsar, sorry, not pulsar, magnetar, whatever, you expect it to have some kind of magnetosphere around it, so lots of charged particles around.
Mm-hmm.
And to some extent, you expect the magnetic field to be generated by those charged particles.
Yeah.
So that will affect the calculation of your screening distance, right?
So, sorry, can you repeat that again?
So, I mean, you usually think of magnetic field lines being sort of frozen into this plasma that's
mm-hmm.
around the magnetar.
Yeah.
So in some sense, the magnetic field is being generated by the plasma, by the charge from the plasma.
Mm-hmm.
So at a given point around the star, magnetic field, in the distance from the source of magnetic field isn't the distance from the star to the point. It's
mm-hmm.
the distance from sort of close by plasma to that point.
That's right.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So, how does that affect the screening?
Not much. Because these are all order one effects. And like, for example, rather than 10 kilometers, you might say the field generating the, whatever is generating the magnetic field is now 20 kilometers in size, in radius, if you include all the plasma surrounding the magnetar. And so.
No, the worry is that it's generated by something that's very close to it.
Yeah, and so why is that a problem?
If you're close to the generating thing, then you don't have time to screen the extra B field, right?
No, so if you let's consider physically what's happening in the case of a wire. Let's say you have a wire here that's I, which is generating a charge,
yeah.
And you ask now how does stringer pair production neutralize the magnetic field generated by this?
Mm-hmm.
You generate, let's say, M minus, M plus. And then now as these guys get shot off to infinity, notice that there's a EMF in here because the flux, dB dt, is changing. And so this causes a force that just slows down the rotation. And so what happens is when you generate these monopoles and they get shot off, let's say the magnetic field is generated by some spinning particles in the magnetosphere. Those guys just slow down.
Yeah, okay. That wasn't quite a question, but maybe.
Okay.
Maybe I have a similar question. So it's a magnetic dipole, right? So is it clear that the monopoles can discharge it?
Yeah, so I think this is sort of your physical picture of how, right? Because at a long distance, you can just zoom in and just see you look like you have a uniform magnetic field. And so what's happening is your monopoles generate it. Or get pair-produced because it can't tell the difference between it being a dipole or not. And then the reason why it slows down the energy of the dipole is just a picture like this where it flies off. It has generated some EMF for this current that's generating your loop. And so the current is now just shrinks a little bit. And so if it's being generated by some physical dipole like this, you can sort of screen it slowly by just having the monopoles generate an EMF through it that just slowly turn it off. And so that's sort of physically what happens in the case if the electric field is being generated by a dipole, or in the case of an electric charge going in a circle. And it's pretty clear from energy conservation this has to happen, but you can even do the calculation yourself and then see this is what happens. That the energy carried away by your monopoles exactly matches how much you sort of decreased the total energy in this system by.
Okay. Well, let's thank Anton again.